I used to visit all the very gay places.
This is music by Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett. Welcome to The Checkout, a podcast and radio show from WBGO. I'm Simon Rettner. Back in the day, before Lady Gaga became a huge pop star, she was singing jazz, like Billy Strayhorn's Lush Life. She revisits her quote-unquote ballin' days with the legendary Tony Bennett on her recording Cheek to Cheek. When Quincy Jones was a teenager, he was determined to study with Clark Terry. Those lessons he learned are documented in the film Keep On Keepin' On. But speaking of ballin', the original baller, Parliament Funkadelic's George Clinton talks about his memoir with Soul Sister. That's up next. This is The Checkout. Thanks for checking in.
Hello, I'm Soul Sister, guest correspondent for The Checkout on WBGO. I'm thrilled to be sitting here with the legendary producer, writer, arranger, vocalist, and genius musical mastermind of the empire known as Parliament Funkadelic, revered by fans and musicians of all genres, Mr. George Clinton. How is everything, George?
I've been de-fleed, de-ticked, and I got my rabies shot, and I'm ready to bury the bone. That's dog talk, y'all.
You have your long-awaited autobiography, which is newly released, entitled Brothers... Well, you tell us the title, please.
Brothers Be Yo, like George. Ain't that funkin' kind of hard on you?
Tell me about that title.
Well, it's actually one of the songs on my new album called First You Gotta Shake the Gate. And it's like, brothers be yo like George. Ain't that funkin' kind of hard on you? I was hard when I started, gonna be hard when I get through.
What made you finally decide to write your life story?
Oh, but it's all part of a bigger plan. And the bigger plan is that I'm doing, and you know I'm doing this fight for copyright recaptures for all the royalties rights that different writers, different people are owed and not getting paid. Even though the artists paid the money, you know, all the rappers paid money out of their royalties to pay myself and a lot of the writers that wrote for me, we don't get the money. The record companies and publishers intervene. And it's a big conspiracy between all those companies that had those samples out there. You know, we tried not to raise any hell about it because we didn't want to hurt none of the groups or rappers. But now it's getting to the point that it's 25 years and that stuff is still hot and nobody's getting paid. So I said, I'll do the book. Because I can bring more attention to it. It's hard to bring attention to it in the courts if you don't have enough money to fight the cases. They'll end up suing you for harassment. Even though they took all your money, that's how big money can do. And so I say, okay, I got another story. I can tell the story. People will hear that. Plus, I got my grandchildren, 7 of them. We got together. I'm doing a reality show. My grandkids called the Clintons. The first family of funk. And that's on the Fuse Network. So I'm putting it all together. That way I can definitely draw attention to my fight. Flashlight 2013. We get our music back starting last year. 35 years since 1978 was 2013. From 2013 on, all the songs that we put out comes back to us. Copyright comes back to you. You own it. Congress passed that. But the record companies is fighting. They lying and they try not to honor it. I just saw when Warner Brothers honored Prince's. He got his back, and he licensed it back to him, which was what's supposed to happen. But the rest of them, since we had so many songs sampled, you know, during this hip-hop period, so many big records, you know, from Tupac to Dre to Snoop to Digital Underground, and De La. So everybody you can think of, you know, had P-Funk songs, along with James Brown, that they sampled. They don't want to give that up. So I just did the book to tell the story.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Tell me, mirror, what is wrong? Can it be my De La clothes or is it just my De La song? What I do ain't make believe. People say I sit and try. But when it comes to being De La, it's just me, myself, and I.
You know, this affects artists across all genres, and you're speaking out as one of the major figures of music, and it touches so many jazz artists as well. I'm curious to know if you were influenced by any jazz artists in particular.
Well, you have to be influenced by jazz artists. First of all, I'm from Newark, New Jersey. I worked in a barbershop there where we did hair, processed hair. Our customers was James Moody. I delivered milk to Sir Vaughn on Avon Avenue. Okay. Wayne Shorter lived on Huntington Street. I lived on Bergen Street, one block apart. Larry Young Jr., he played keyboards. I remember when he sang doo-wop, sang bass in a group called The Foremost. So not only that, but then after that, Herbie's and Miles and everybody, you have to learn from them. They learn from you, you learn from them. Funk is the, jazz is the evolution of everything that happened. If you start off singing doo-wop, it ended up being jazz after you get old enough. Start off playing blues, it ended up being jazz. You know what I'm saying? It's, jazz is where you graduate to. I didn't pay no attention to when I was younger because I was doo-wop and trying to get my own set of girls. And most of them was too young to know what was happening with jazz. Me too. We was into doo-wop. But as you start learning your craft, you realize that's what you're trying to perfect it to be able to call it that. You don't want to say that. But then when I talked to Miles, he done did it so good that way. He's ready to come back, go the opposite way. He's trying to find out where the new elementary music is at, so he can take it and make it jazz worthy. I feel like that with funk. We got so long, it ended up being jazzy, classical, and all of that, you know, with Bernie's and the music. You eventually end up there, but I realize I have to flip it back and go back to kindergarten, because that's where the new music always start at. Well, they spit in the beat, or saying bow, 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 bow. Or singing like we were singing, whoa, hi, hey. You know, it's all very elementary in the beginning. But as you get better, you get sophisticated. And then little kids don't want to hear you no more because you done got too grown. So you have to flip it back because the next era is going to come along and you're going to be saying, that ain't music. That's what you'll do once you get, you know, that ain't music. But when I hear somebody say, that ain't music, that's the music I want. Because now I can go back and start all over and get a few more years and work its way to jazz.
Talk to me quick.
Let me know, whatever.
We want your mind to blow.
My mind to grow. Is that all?
Let me know. We want your mind to blow. We want your mind to blow.
So many of the jazz artists are influenced by you, and one that immediately comes to mind is George Duke, who had his late 1970s hits Reach For It and Dookie Stick. They sounded exactly like P-Funk songs or P-Funk Party, and then some years later, George Duke and Stanley Clarke actually covered Mothership Connection. What do you remember about George Duke and his love of P-Funk? Did he ever talk to you about it?
Well, you know, I did the video with him on the Mothership Connection. And Dennis Chamber was our drummer. He played with him. And Stanley Clarke, of course, I guess he was a fan of Bootsy. Bootsy was a fan of his. So, I mean, they were funky in the first place. You know, he was doing some crazy stuff with Frank Zappa when they was together. So it was just that we just went on and did it. And he saw a chance to do something that he was having fun with all along, George Duke, you know. But then, like I said, we've been around so long. What, no matter what music it is, if you're around long enough, you'll see it becoming something that jazz people will actually eventually, well, let me do it this way, let me do it that way. It could be doo-wop, rock and roll, it could be whatever. You know, you'll find somebody that's got enough. Miles just went on and did it as soon as it came out. He didn't wait for it. Mm-hmm. I saw him playing Cyndi Lauper song, you know, and he don't care. Jazz is just a name for him. It's just he played all music, and that's the way I look at it. But all music will eventually find its way there. And now that you're getting a lot of Eastern people over here now, you're going to find a lot of that in jazz music pretty soon. You find it in hip-hop already. You're hearing sounds from India and Arab sounds. You're going to get some artists that's going, oh, sure, I can do it like this. And that's another whole scale. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to hear it being funked with, but
George Clinton joins us on The Checkout. I'm guest contributor, Soul Sister. Your musical roots are based in singing doo-wop in New Jersey in the 1950s. And so you had the Parliaments. Tell us about the Parliaments. The
Parliaments was our version of what was going on after we heard Why Do Fools Fall in Love by Frankie Lyman, The Spaniels, Good Night, Sweetheart, The Flamingos, Shubop Shubop. All the stars out tonight. Everybody, after Frank and Lyman, Little Anthony, and all of them came out, 56 and 7, everybody wanted to be a singer all around Jersey, New York, Brooklyn, Philadelphia. That was the thing. Everybody wanted to have a doo-wop group. So Parliament, our neighborhood, the Monotones did, who wrote the Book of Love, they left the hood and got that hit record. You knew that it was possible. Later on, it was the Fiestas with So Fine. It was getting closer and closer. There was always somebody near us, you know, getting those records. And then over in Brooklyn, you know, the Fort Greene Project groups, all the. And then in Harlem, you had the Cadillacs, you know, the Velours and Turbans. My heart is in doo-wop. So I did some doo-wop. And something they call Northern Soul, which is old, you know, music. Doo-wop to me ended in 59 when Motown came along. Motown was the new doo-wop. Temptation took it up a notch, you know, or two, Miracles. So we went there with them. So that's how we left Detroit. I left Jersey. I worked for Joe Bett as a songwriter. Then I went out to Detroit. And I started doing the Motown thing. I got a hit record called I Just Want to Testify What Your Love Has Done For Me. And this is about 65, 66. Inquisitive friends are asking me what's come over me. A change, there's been a change, and it's oh so plain to see. Everybody was flirting with the talent. Even Eric Clapton and them, Eric called it rock and roll. But they were doing Greek mythology, music and the songs, and the music wasn't your average three-chord blues. I mean, they did a lot of that. That was their basic thing, but they definitely had other stuff on top. We did the same thing with Bernie, and that gave us another sound that people didn't know what the hell were they doing. Sometimes it'd be too black for white folks or too white for black folks. But in the end, people that like music said, damn, they doing something that works. And later on, we had Bootsy, Fred Westy, Maceo Parker, which was the James Brown band. They all had a chance to stretch out and do the stuff that they weren't able to do as a dance band with James. And we let them stretch out, and it got real artsy-fartsy by the time we got to Funkadelic. You know what I'm saying? And then that was like the height of, before we had to like, okay, let's turn around and go back and start all over again, which was Atomic Dog. We had to go back and do what hip-hoppers were doing. Not spit the beat, but come close to it. Sample the songs and, you know, have those kind of electronic grooves and sound effects. That's what Atomic Dog was, the beginning of like what hip-hop was doing. We'll be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, street dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, clapping dogs, funky dogs, nasty dogs.
I want to ask you about one of the amazing classic funk records that you did with Parliament, in particular Mothership Connection from 1975, which was not only a hit album blending funk, R&B, jazz, soul, and dance music, but was based on a futuristic concept and character of the spaceship and the character Starchild. Tell me about the Mothership and Starchild.
Well, you know, I'm from the Dog Star. Sirius, the planet Sirius. Mothership is just something, you know what, and I didn't realize it, but I had already heard it in my, you know, in my head from my kids, you know, because they were all Muslims. No. So, I mean, there's a whole folk tale there about the Mothership coming down, Farrakhan, you know, saying that. I had heard it. I did not relate it to that until after I put the record out. And we play in Philadelphia, and all the brothers in there with the bow ties, and the place was smelling like fish sandwiches, and they was all brothers in the front. Speak the knowledge, brother. And I'm like, I'm not trans. I didn't mean to transgress. That's when you hear me say, ain't nothing but a party. Because I don't want to get blamed for no, you know, sacrilege thing here. I'm getting paid. But it was coming through me, whether I believed it or not. Or thought I was joking or not, because it lasts too long. People believe in it so strong. Now, I'm myself is beginning to give it more attention than I did back then, because to me, I feel like I'm getting high and having a party and drugging. It's a nice topic to talk about. So, but it's got to be more than that to last this long.
Mothership Connection. Home of the people. The bomb. Doing it in 3D. Let me put on my sunglasses here so I can see what I'm doing.
Come, for I am here.
just heard Mothership Connection by Parliament from 1975. We can't wait for this incredible year coming up and many more to come. The book, the TV show, the recording, and also the advocacy that you're doing for the musicians in regards to copyrights.
Yep. All of that, you know, is what I tried to focus on in the book and in the album, new album, the reality show. The Clintons, first family of funk. You know, Sly Stone is on the album. About four or five songs on there. He had the same fight with the copyrights and people taking his money. You're going to see a lot of that come up in a minute in the courts because we've been working with him trying to help him. Because you don't have nobody, you know, when you're out there, especially if you're out there, you know, like we were on drugs. You're having your fun out there, but you don't. So you get what you ask for, but it ain't never too late to change your mind and say, I want to straighten it out. I don't care what I did. I'm here now saying I'm straightening it out with my grandkids and my kids and everything else. It's my right. They should have finished the job when they had me down.
The original, not just Knee Deep, by the original George Clinton. He spoke with WWOZ's Soul Sister. Coming up next, Remembering Clark Terry in a film documentary with Quincy Jones and Alan Hicks. They join WBGO's Gary Walker. This is The Checkout. I'm Simon Rettner.
Hi, I'm Gary Walker, and here on The Checkout, we're chatting with film director Alan Hicks and producer Quincy Jones, the life and times and mentoring skills of the great Clark Terry. It's a new documentary called Keep On Keepin' On.
When I first met Clark Terry, I was must have been about 13 years old, and there was a theater there where all the big guys came, the Palomar Theater. And I just to sit and listen to him play, you know.
When I was with Basie's small group, this kid, this little skinny, scrawny-looking kid would come by the gig every night, and he'd say to me, Mr. Terry, my name is Quincy Jones, and I would like to take some lessons from you.
He was my idol man. At that time, I didn't know anything. You know, I just was hell-bent on being even just around this man, you know, to hear whatever he had to say.
And he was real thin, skinny. He was thin enough to ride a rooster. So I said, well, you go to school and you're sleeping all night and I'm up in the clubs all over the place. When you go to school in the daytime, that's when I'm sleeping.
And of course it takes a lot of courage, you know, to go to somebody like that. But, I mean, it's my only chance, you know. If I didn't say something, that may never have happened.
The film Keep On Keepin' On, you referenced, you were a very young guy when you went to the Palomar. What gave you the courage to go there?
The courage, it was being inquisitive and nosy. Man, they had no TV then. And all the new bebop songs that came from Bird in New York, there was no communication. And so everybody came through there. It would be Sammy Davis, he'd have his vinyl playing and earphones on, playing bongos with it. Milton May, Billy Eckstein had watched Bobby Tucker's fingers on the keys, playing. That was a young kid, you know. and Clark Terry, and I just want to be around them and hear all the slangs, everything, man, and grow, you know. And with Clark, I basically had only four horns back then. Wardell Gray, Serge Taloff, Buddy DeFranco, and Clark. That's as good as it gets, man. And he lost all his money gambling, you know, so he couldn't keep his big band together. So he had to stay in Vancouver and Seattle and Oregon to stay off the East Coast because he wanted to know he was broke, you know. And Billy Eckstein gave him money to put his big band back together again. Eckstein did.
That's a pretty tight, small group.
Yes, it is. That's pretty good, man. I was there every day, man, just listening and learning. And
what kind of reception did you get from Clark Terry?
Well, as I said, I was a little skinny dude, you know. but most people feel like this. And I know people come and ask for autographs and pictures. They say, well, I'm never going to see you again. This is the only shot I got, so I can't help it whether you're upset or not. But I had to ask Clark. I couldn't resist it because if I didn't, you don't ask, you don't get, you know. And I said, I just love to study with you because my mouth used to bleed when I put the horn like that because my armature was wrong. And he said, no, put it up here. And diaphragmatic breathing, all that stuff. He teaches a science. That Clark goes to the science of, he's dealing with the left brain, you know, and that's the one where the work comes, you know. In the picture, he says, they don't work hard enough, you know.
I find it fascinating that the guy that was born in St. Louis, poor, you don't know poor, until you look at the background of Clark Terry.
My full name is Clark Terry Jr. I was born in 1920 in St. Louis, Missouri, 6207 South Broadway. I'm one of 11 kids, and we were dead poor. My dad was a hard-working man. I was 7 years old when my mother passed, and I've been missing her dearly ever since. I was about 10 years old when I first heard the Ellington Band, and it blew my mind. After hearing that band, I wanted to play the trumpet so bad that I made one. So I went down to the dump, found an old piece of hose, and bent it around. Then I took an old kerosene funnel, stuck it in the end, and made a bell out of it. In the other end, I took a piece of lead pipe and made a mouthpiece out of it. Of course, I didn't know that lead was poisonous at the time.
Going in the junkyard and finding that horn with the hose and the funnel and the lead pipe and didn't care, didn't know that lead was poisonous.
And didn't care.
And started playing.
Yeah, it's amazing. My grandmother lived there, too, down in the place. We had the same kind of affluent neighborhood, you know. Joke. Terrible.
But I find it fascinating that his inspiration for going to that junkyard was hearing Duke Ellington. And then a little more than a decade later, he's on a stage,
yeah,
being introduced by Duke Ellington.
And 12 years after that, he comes and joins my band. It's crazy, man.
He leaves Duke Ellington to come to Paris.
With Quentin Jackson.
Free and easy.
Quentin came too. Butter, remember Quentin Butter Jackson?
Yeah.
They both came to Paris. I almost had a heart attack. It was so beautiful. That's really the biggest honor I ever had in my life, man.
And then you returned that favor later on, didn't you? Clark Terry broke racial barriers, too, in addition to his exceptional abilities to reach out, you know, each one teach one. Why, he's done that thousands of times. But he also broke racial barriers at NBC and opened doors for a whole lot of musicians while that kind of thing still existed in this town. And out west, too.
Heavy.
Hi, I'm Gary Walker, and here on The Checkout, we're chatting with film director Alan Hicks and producer Quincy Jones, the life and times and mentoring skills of the great Clark Terry. It's a new documentary called Keep On Keepin' On. I sat down with the director and producer to talk about this legendary musician and inspiration to so many who come after him.
Alan, what inspired you to make this film? You're not a filmmaker. Well, you are now, but you weren't then.
Just tell him he's really in it now.
Originally it was to be a short piece on myself and Clark for Australian TV and our friendship, but that fell through, and I was surfing with a buddy of mine, a guy called Adam Hart, who's the cinematographer in the film, and I just said, hey, this idea for a film about Clark popped up, and I'm upset that it didn't come through, and he just said, mate, we'll just do it ourselves, let's just go for it. And so we paddled in, saved some money, bought a camera, and started learning how to make a documentary. And using that whole idea with studying jazz, you know, repetition and really working hard into documentary, trying to really understand how to make one. And then we just started shooting for a year with Clark and just getting as much of his history as we could. And because I'd spent all these years with him already, I knew a lot of the stories and was able to document all of that stuff. And we had lots of great stories and lots of interviews from musicians like Jimmy Heath and Herbie Hancock. And they would all say Clark's one of the greatest trumpet players and flugelhornists of all time, but he's also one of the greatest teachers. And we had the archival to back it up of Clark as a player, but we didn't have him with a student. So that's when I approached Justin Coughlin, who was in the band with us, and he was always studying with Clark, and asked if we could follow him as well. And as soon as we made that shift, the story just started to blossom and go in places where I couldn't have predicted.
When I finally lost my sight, I didn't have video games anymore. I didn't have basketball or just going outside to play with my friends.
That went away. After that went away, I was like, well, what do I have to do? What can I do? You know, I went to school and I'm here at home. What is there? And I kind of just gravitated towards the piano, just kind of sat at the piano and fell in love with it that way.
Did you see something special between Justin and CT?
Yeah, most definitely. Like, because with Justin, the way Justin met Clark is Clark was actually losing his sight while I was in his band, and he was fretting about it a lot. And Justin happened to come to the college at that same time, and I just asked Clark if I could bring Justin around, this young blind kid, and he said, yeah, no worries. And so I brought Justin over, and that first night that they met, I was there with them, and Justin just was telling Clark about his experience going blind and how it really calmed Clark down, you know, hearing from this young kid that he'd gone blind 7 years earlier. And Clark's got synesthesia, and so does Justin, seeing colours with music. And I think, Quincy, you've got that too, yeah? You see colour with music.
Synesthesia.
Yeah. And so he was explaining that to Clark as well, because for Justin, it's a very visual experience listening to music. And anyways, that's the foundation of their relationship. It started there, not as a young piano player trying to get to Clark Terry. It was actually a very mutual friendship. And then Clark heard him play and was like, man, you've got to join my band.
But at the same time, when he brings him into the fold and teaches him, there's a friendliness, but there's a sternness, because he says, you got to try harder. You got to try harder, right? You just don't want to do it. You want to do it right.
Well, that's Clark, man. He's the master, you know. And there's a lot of... It's actually very tough studying with Clark as well. It's because he cares so much about his students.
And it should be like that, too. That's what makes you better, that guys don't try hard enough. That's the one they didn't like. Because they say... I always tell my kids that the dictionary is the only place you find work or success before work, and that's alphabetical. You gotta work, man. Gotta work. God gives you a talent. You owe God the work.
They say that you can always sense through a person's music the type of person he is, you know. And there's something to that, because I know there's some guys who are vicious, uptight, and evil, and they sound vicious, uptight, and evil. And I would like not to sound vicious, uptight, and evil. I like to sound relaxed and enjoyable, and even in some occasions, beautiful, you know. Although I'm an old, ugly ham, you know. I'd like to think of at least my soul as being beautiful.
Yeah, that reference in the movie when Clark's talking about people that's... are vicious, uptight, and evil, will sound vicious, uptight, and evil, and he doesn't want to sound like that. He wants to sound beautiful, and you know, and that's a big theme in the film, is trying to find your own voice. Something that intrigued me so much about Clark is, like, what is it that this guy does to help these people find themselves? And that was I was making a discovery along the way in the filmmaking to try and work that out, and to me, I learned that it's about being a good person first, and that's something that Clark's really passionate about.
Clark Terry playing with Bob Brookmeyer Quintet, Haig & Haig, from the recording Gingerbread. Keep On Keepin' On is the name of the film documentary about Clark Terry, directed by Alan Hicks, and starring the legendary Quincy Jones. They talk to WBGO's Gary Walker. Go to keeponkeepinon.com to learn more about the movie. Coming up next, Lady Gaga sings The Great American Songbook. She joins WBGO's Michael Bourne. This is The Checkout. I'm Simon Rettner.
I want a little girl to call my own, one that I can speak with on the telephone.
Call up.
Just a little girl to
get two, save me one, Clark.
I want a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
She may not look like a picture in a storybook, but if she can cook, she's just a little girl for me.
I repeat, if you get two, save me one.
The American Popular Songbook, those songs from the 20s and on, have endured. One of the keepers of the American Popular Songbook. He's been singing since the 1940s, since some of these songs were actually brand new. And they're always brand new when they're performed by Tony Bennett. Lady Gaga came along in recent years as a sensation of what she called art pop. Spectacular. But people didn't realize that behind all the sometimes kinky but spectacular shows she was doing was the heart of a jazz singer since she was a child. And she's going to talk about that with me.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails.
Lush Life is a hell of a song, and it's a song you've talked so much about the telling. You want to tell a story. You're telling the story of jazz when you're singing jazz. You're telling the story of all the music that you perform. What is the story of this music that you're singing now with Tony Bennett?
You know, I started singing jazz when I was really very young. I was maybe 13 years old. And I had been listening to it with my mom on Sundays. She would always play Billie Holiday on Sunday. So then around 13, you know, that's when I discovered Ella Fitzgerald. And I started to go out down the street. There was a boys' school where they had a jazz band. And I would audition to sing in it. And they loved my jazz voice. So they would have me sing a lot of songs. So then I learned a lot more about the Great American Songbook. But I had a wonderful teacher, Mr. Phillips. He came to me one day and he said, you know, you really got to sing this song. He said, I just think you could really sing the hell out of this song. And he played it for me and he sort of sang it to me on the piano. And it was Billy Strayhorn, Lush Life. And I was just a kid.
Life is lonely. And only last year, everything seems so sure.
So, you know, I didn't really understand what the song was about. And I didn't, I'd never really heard such an intricate, complex melodic line like that before. But I started to cry. And I got very emotional when he played it for me, and I loved it. And I then listened to all the different versions of it and tried to, you know, create my own and just improvise with the song as much as I could. But it wasn't until 15 years later, now in this moment with Mr. Tony Bennett, that I started to sing the song in the studio, and I cried again. And it was the same tears, except for this time I knew exactly what the song was about. And, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say to answer your question is the story began a long ago, but that's because I fell in love with music before I can even remember having my first thoughts. And then now, returning to jazz, it's like returning to my true nature, and I'm able to truly look at my life and myself and how I've changed.
Tony always talks about the art of singing the popular songbook is the art of intimate singing. And,
yes.
And a song like Lush Life, when I was listening to you in the soundcheck, and I told you that there was this one phrase you did that was just so it was so right, it was so touching. And then you have to do that on a stage with 1,000, 2,000 people listening in a big hall and everything to create that intimacy still with all those people in that enormous space. And that's still really that's the art. That's the craft, really.
For me, in order to really sing jazz the right way, like Tony's saying, in that intimate way, it's when you're singing to one person. And if you're singing those lyrics, I mean, when I sing Cole Porter lyrics, and that note, if it's hitting in my own body in the vibration in the right way where it's really coming out of my spirit and my soul, you know, that's when we start to cry. And it's not even, the audience. And the audience is just, really witnessing a conversation between Tony and I. And then they remember, oh, no, they're talking to me. And then that's the thing about art. Art, ultimately, for me, is all about interaction. And if you can make somebody feel something very strong by interacting with them, by telling them this story, and I can't help it when I sing that song. I actually can't help it when I sing any song with Tony now, because, I didn't realize how much more I loved singing jazz than singing pop music until Tony called me. It's like I forgot. It's powerful. I don't got anybody sitting around me telling me we should put auto-tune on this vocal, or we should make it sound more electronic, or, this is the new thing now. It's none of that. It's actually Tony, like, with a sword and a shield standing around me going, don't you tell her what to do. You just put that mic on and let her sing, and I'll tell you which one's her best take.
Yeah.
And, and that is an invaluable lesson and moment for me in my life right now. You've been in the business for years. I'm sure you know the difference. It's like, it's very hard to be a female recording artist, to be a female artist, period. And somebody like Tony is like a true gentleman. It's I've waited a life, the first lifetime of my music, for someone like him to come along and say, okay, I'm gonna show you how it's done.
They say into your early life romance came, and in this heart of yours burned a flame that flickered one day and died away.
I'm Michael Bourne. I'm cheek to cheek with Lady Gaga, one of the nicest people I've met in a long time. No wonder she gets along with the nicest guy in showbiz, Tony Bennett.
He's so nice. Oh, my gosh.
And so are you. You are really, really nice. And I kept telling that to people. She's so nice. And it's true. You being a piano player, you're aware of the complexity of the harmony in a Cole Porter song or an Irving Berlin song or a Duke Ellington song, that there's so much underneath all of that. And yet
yes.
It's within that you are still also blowing on the changes, as it were, like any jazz musician does. You are improvising
the
words. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I do that. Yeah, well, I do that too. I sometimes feel bad about doing that. When I listen back, I go, oh, why did I do that? Who do you think you are thinking you can sing a better lyric than Cole Porter? But, then I remember that I was having a moment, and, Cole Porter would want me to have a moment.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
When you write your songs, you are creating. When you are singing a Cole Porter song or an Irving Berlin song, a Duke Ellington song, you are recreating.
I feel like a vehicle, like a tunnel from the past. And I feel, it's a really high honor to sing the Great American Songbook with Tony, because, he wouldn't sing it with someone that he didn't think was any good. You know him. He'll tell you in four bars if somebody can sing.
I know you're bound to answer when we propose. Anything goes, go.
You knocked him out. I mean, he talked about how much you love the music, not just how beautifully you sing the music, but how much you love the music, and that's what matters
to
him.
Oh, I love it. Tony, he's an artist. He's a real artist, so, the art side of me, too, the person that's obsessed with, modern art, and I do those performance art pieces where, it's almost like a seance where we're channeling the artists that have come before us. To be there when we're doing these performance art installations. I feel that same thing when I'm with Tony. It's like when we're in the room together, I just feel the souls of, every jazz singer that came before him. And I'm really truly asking them the whole time that I'm there. I'm saying, as humbly as I can look. Like, I know I haven't shown the world that I can do this yet, but maybe if I can show you, you'll give me a sign that it's okay that I'm doing this. Because, you know, that it really means something to me to honor jazz and to bring it to the younger generation and to make Tony as proud as I can.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek. When we're out together dancing cheek to cheek.
I was seeing your interview with Anderson Cooper, and you were talking about trying to get the audience to pay attention to this or that. Sometimes it's a social message, or it's an emotional message in a song or a story that you're singing. And you have an audience now that listens to your music, knows you, loves you, but they're hearing music, even though these songs have been around for decades, they haven't heard Cole Porter before.
Oh, I love to climb a mountain and reach the highest peak.
Me too. But what do you want them to get out of this?
I would say the one that I find to be like the most universal message, the one that really truly connects Tony and I and also connects the fans with us through the music and the composers and the songs, is that at any point in your life, whether you're young or you're old or you're somewhere in between, you can always return to your true nature. And your true nature will always be the most beautiful part of you. Because we're artists, we want to create things, we want to make them beautiful, but they can never be as amazing, truly, as a real tree, or a real mountain, or the real ocean. And what I have found in singing jazz with Tony is that there's a part of me that is just my nature, that is not part of my art really in any way. It's just who I am, and the same way that it is for him. And I want people all over the world to know that no matter where they have come to in their lives, what they've become, how they've changed, go back to that first glimmer of passion for a moment and strip everything else away. Return to your true nature, and you will be so revived in your life, and it will be the most beautiful part of you. You will be so shocked.
And then one day, one magic day, he passed my way.
And while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me: the greatest thing
you'll ever learn
is just to love and be loved in return.
Michael Bourne, I'm getting cheek to cheek with Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga. The latter called me while on tour in Australia. When did you first hear Tony singing this music?
Oh, well, I mean, since I was a little bitty. You mean these songs?
I mean, did you hear Tony when you were first hearing Ella and Billie Holiday and being excited
yes,
by them?
Yes, of course I did. Tony was a staple in the Germanotta house, as well as Frank. You know, and we listened to a lot of duets. I loved listening to duets. Oh, I mean, I'm such a huge Tony Bennett fan. When I found out that he wanted to meet me, my mother and I screamed. We were backstage at the Robin Hood event for the impoverished people in New York. And my mother and I were in a trailer, and we screamed, and we started to fix our hair, and my father started laughing and shaking his head. And we ran to meet Mr. Bennett, and oh my gosh, it was the most wonderful thing. I cried when I introduced him to my grandmas at the PBS event. You know, it was like the proudest moment.
It's fascinating to me because having seen some of your shows and see you do something so art pop and spectacular, and yet in a couple of times when I've seen you, in the middle of all that, you would just sit down at the piano and it would just be you playing and singing, and it would be transformative. It would be, you know, there's the shock, you know, of, oh, let's see how spectacular and wild and beautiful and crazy this can be. But then there's the surprise that comes when you pull somebody like into your heart, into your soul, like you were doing in some of those songs, some of your own songs like that.
Thank you. I think especially the ballads that I've written for the albums will be the ones that I'll always really truly cherish. You know, I think, you know, Speechless, the song I wrote about my father, You and I, that song, and
yeah, that's
Dope,
a wonderful song.
And you know, I think what the thing that sometimes people don't realize, which because I don't always explain it, is that, you know, decadence and in the underground community, you know, and that sort of, it's called, you know, balling, and sort of these theatrical parties. This is something, this is a culture that still exists, and it's very, very strong, and it's where I was living when I first came out. So it's, you know, part of my love of putting on a show is paying homage to that, living the glamorous life without any money, you know, the starving artist that lives glamorously. And, you know, that sort of, I guess, segues into one of the most endearing parts of my story with Tony and I is that Tony took interest in my band, my jazz band that I've been singing with for 7 years, the Brian Newman Quintet. You know, I really believe in these guys. They have a very modern sound. It's very different. It's kind of dirty New York. They play five nights a week in the, you know, in New York City, all around. You know, the kids know them. And I just said, you know, I just want Tony to see and meet the kids that want to be him. You know, that wake up every day and think, man, I want to feel like Tony Bennett today. So I introduced them to him, and he loved them so much, and he loved their music and loved their arrangements, and now they're on the album. And, you know, I could just cry talking about it because he just changed their whole life, you know? I mean, he changed all of our lives because they're from that same scene. That scene, we didn't have any money, but we had cigarettes rolled up in our sleeves, and we had beer and Coney Island and, you know, somebody's Buick, and we had each other. And it's like now we have jazz. And that jazz that we always had, we now get to thank a legend every time we play with him by saying, you know, every horn, every bass line, every piano lick, every time I open my mouth and sing, it's my way of saying, thank you, Tony, thank you, Tony, thank you. Thank you so much, because this is what we want to be doing.
Lady Gaga with WBGO's Michael Bourne.
We love each other so deeply.
A special thanks goes out to Downbeat Magazine, who features Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett on the cover of their October 2014 issue. If you want to hear the full one-hour special with Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett, go to our website, our blog, at WBGO.org. The Checkout is a podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. All of our shows are archived on our website at checkoutjazz.org. And follow us on Twitter at checkoutjazz. Special thanks to Harry Terrell and Tim Wilkins. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for listening.